The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. This audiobook narration presents Art. Investing in North America, Buy, Value, and Resell. Fine Art with Discipline Topic, Introduction, The Room Goes Quiet Just Before the Lot Reaches the Block. A bidder in the back row glances down at the catalogue, then up at the canvas, as if the work might reveal one last clue about what it will be worth 5 years from now. On the wall, it is easy to admire the colour, the scale, the name. In the sales room, though, admiration is only the beginning. The real question is whether this object can ever become cash again without losing too much of its value along the way. That question sits at the centre of fine art investing in North America, where the market is both glamorous and stubbornly practical. In New York, the auction houses can move a famous work through a room full of specialists, advisors, and collectors in a matter of minutes. In Toronto, Vancouver, Chicago, Los Angeles, or Montreal, a buyer may be looking at the same artist from a different angle, with different taxes, shipping costs, and cross-border complications in play. The setting changes, but the basic tension stays the same. You are not just buying beauty, you are buying an asset that may or may not hold its value well enough to justify the journey from purchase to sale. That is why art refuses to behave like a stock, a bond, or a rental property. Stocks trade on public exchanges with visible pricing and quick execution. Bonds pay interest. Real estate can produce rent. Fine art usually does none of those things. It does not send you cash flow while you wait. It does not promise a neat yield. It can sit on a wall for years and still be difficult to price with confidence. A work can be extraordinary and still be hard to resell. A famous name can still disappoint if the edition is weak, the condition is poor, or the market has moved on. You will hear a few recurring terms throughout this book because they shape almost every decision. Provenance is the ownership chain that helps show where a work has been, who held it, and whether the title looks clean. Liquidity is how easily that work can be turned back into cash. Primary market means buying first, usually directly from the artist or a gallery representing the artist. Secondary market means buying after the first sale, often through auction, a dealer, or a private transaction. Those distinctions sound technical, but they are really about control, evidence, and exit. The art market rewards patience, not speed. That is what makes it attractive to some first-time investors and dangerous to others. A patient buyer may like the idea of owning something physical, something with history and presence, something that can live beside a financial portfolio instead of inside a spreadsheet. That same buyer may also like the idea of diversification, because art does not always move in lockstep with stocks and bonds. And there is a psychological appeal too. A work on a wall feels more real than a line item in an account. But none of those feelings guarantees a profitable outcome. Taste can guide you toward quality. It cannot replace evidence. That is where the market's famous names become useful as signposts. Andy Warhol reminds you that blue chip art can command staggering sums when reputation, rarity, and cultural recognition line up. Jean-Michel Basquiat shows how contemporary status can harden into lasting demand. Beeple, whose March 11th, 2021 Sontay, will push digital art into mainstream finance, signals how novelty can attract capital before the market fully knows what to make of it. Banksy, especially in the aftermath of Love is in the Bin, reminds you that spectacle can become part of the story the market pays for. These names do not tell you what to buy. They show you how many different forces can shape value at once. And value in art is rarely straightforward. Two works by the same artist can sell for very different prices because size, subject, condition, year, edition, and buyer demand all matter. A print is not just a print. A photograph is not just a photograph. A sculpture may require special handling, installation, or storage. Even a celebrated work can carry costs that do not appear in the headline number. Commissions, buyer premiums, shipping, insurance, customs, storage, and taxes can all change the economics before you ever hang the piece. For that reason, you need to think like an investor even when the object invites you to think like a collector. The market does not reward vague enthusiasm. It rewards disciplined questions. Who might buy this later? Through what channel? At what price? After how long? What documentation will that future buyer expect to see? What would happen if you needed to sell sooner than planned? Those questions are not signs of coldness. They are signs that you understand the difference between liking a work and making a thesis about it. The good news is that fine art investing is not mysterious once you separate the romance from the structure. You can learn how the market is organized, why the United States has deeper auction infrastructure than Canada, why cross-border buying changes the real cost of a purchase, and why some categories carry more risk than others. You can learn how to read a provenance file, how to think about condition, how to compare auction estimates with asking prices, and how to spot the hidden fee stack before it eats into returns. You can also learn when a sale result is evidence and when it is only headline noise. This introduction is meant to give you the map before you walk into the room. Fine art can belong in a North American portfolio, but only as a small, patient, carefully documented slice of capital. It is an alternative asset, not a shortcut. It can preserve meaning, signal taste, and sometimes grow in value. It can also sit illiquid, expensive to maintain, and frustratingly hard to exit. The challenge, then, is not deciding whether art is interesting. It is deciding whether the path from ownership to resale makes sense before the first bid is ever placed. If you understand that one question, you are ready for the rest of the book. The next chapter begins where most beginners eventually have to begin, with the case for art as an investment, and the limits that make it unlike almost anything else you can buy. End of introduction. Fine art becomes an investment only when you stop treating it as a purely decorative object and start asking a harder question about resale. What is the path from purchase to sale, and what would have to be true for that path to make sense? You can still love a painting for its colour, its history, or the way it changes a room. In investment terms, though, it is also an asset that may appreciate, sometimes sharply, without the steady cash flow that makes many other holdings easier to measure. This is general information, not financial advice. That dual nature is the core idea. The enjoyment is real. The ownership is real. The return potential is real too. But only if you buy with enough discipline to survive the long delay between purchase and exit. Art is not a shortcut, and it is not built for speed. Unlike a stock, it does not pay dividends. Unlike a bond, it does not distribute interest. Unlike a rental property, it does not produce monthly income. The market is uneven in a way that surprises beginners. Two works by the same artist can sell for very different prices depending on size, condition, subject, year, provenance, and buyer demand. You can also face a high fee stack on both ends, from commissions and premiums to shipping, insurance, storage and, in some cases, tax friction. When it is time to sell, the right buyer may not appear quickly. A fast resale can happen, but it is not the default. That is why the beginner appeal of art often comes down to three ideas that sound simple and can be useful when handled carefully. The first is diversification. Art can behave differently from public markets, so some investors like the idea of adding an asset whose price does not move in perfect step with stocks and bonds. The second is the inflation narrative. tangible assets can feel sturdier when money seems to lose purchasing power, and art often gets placed in that same mental category as other scarce objects. The third is psychological. People like owning something physical. A work on a wall feels more concrete than a line item in an account. Those three attractions are genuine, but none of them guarantees profit. Diversification only helps if the position is small enough to absorb uncertainty. Inflation protection varies by segment and timing, and the satisfaction of ownership can easily slide into overconfidence if you confuse taste with a thesis. The right comparison set keeps that blur in check. Stocks trade on public exchanges with visible pricing, fast execution, and daily liquidity. Bonds usually move within a clearer yield framework, even when prices fluctuate. Real estate is less liquid than either of those, but it can produce rent and can often be appraised using neighborhood comparables, financing terms, and recent sales. Fine art sits in a different corner of the landscape. Much of its pricing is private or semi-private. Some works are negotiated quietly through galleries or dealers. Others are sold at auction, where competition can push the final number far above or below expectations. Many works have no income stream at all. You are not collecting yield in the ordinary sense. You are betting that someone else will value the work more highly later, and that the market for that work will still be healthy when you are ready to sell. That makes art part of the broader alternative asset family, alongside collectibles, private businesses, wine, watches, and other tangible stores of value. The family resemblance matters. These assets often rely on scarcity, provenance, craftsmanship, and reputation rather than on daily earnings reports. They also share the same weakness. They can be hard to price and harder to unwind. You can feel rich on paper while still being short of cash in practice. That is why art is best understood not as a substitute for a core portfolio, but as a satellite position around one. It belongs on the edge of a broader liquid portfolio, not at the center of a financial life that depends on flexible cash access. For North American buyers, geography matters more than many first-time investors expect. The United States has the deeper auction and gallery center, with more inventory, more frequent sales, and a thicker layer of intermediaries. Canada has a serious art scene, but local supply is often thinner, especially at the higher end. That difference pushes Canadian buyers toward cross-border purchases more often, and cross-border buying brings its own friction. Exchange rates can change the true cost of the work. Shipping and customs can add expense and delay. Tax treatment can vary depending on structure and use. None of that makes the purchase impossible. It simply means you need to think beyond the sticker price. In art, the quoted number is rarely the whole cost. That cost discipline matters because the suitability bar is straightforward. Fine art investing fits best when you have spare capital, a long holding horizon, tolerance for uncertainty, and no need to sell quickly for cash. Those are not decorative traits. They are the difference between a thoughtful allocation and a forced mistake. If you may need the money next year, you are not buying an art investment. You are taking a liquidity risk that the object itself cannot solve. If you can hold for years, accept valuation ambiguity, and wait for the right market, you can play a different game. In practice, the smartest framing is to treat art as an optional slice of capital, not as a main engine of wealth building. That framing also helps keep you from overreaching on size. A healthy art allocation is usually small relative to total assets, because the position is illiquid and idiosyncratic. Even when a work is excellent, it may still take time to sell. Even when the market is strong, you may still face a spread between what you paid and what you can recover. The real question is not whether art can be part of a portfolio. it is whether the portfolio can afford to wait. A patient collector with a liquid financial base can afford to experiment in a way that a cash-strapped buyer cannot. Once you settle the allocation question, you still have to navigate the gatekeepers. Auction houses sit at one end of the market, where public bidding creates visible price discovery. Major galleries sit at another, often controlling access to artists, shaping presentation, and setting primary market prices through relationship and reputation. Advisors sit between you and the market, translating taste into acquisition strategy and helping with due diligence. Online marketplaces make inventory easier to scan, and fractional ownership platforms promise lower entry points by dividing ownership claims into smaller pieces. Each of these channels solves one problem and creates another. Auction houses offer transparency, but can be volatile. Galleries offer curation, but often keep price negotiations out of public view. Advisors reduce search costs, but add fees. Online platforms widen access, but can make quality control harder to judge. Fractional platforms can lower the first ticket size while adding structure, expense, and complexity that beginners often underestimate. You also run into the four broad entry categories that usually shape the first serious decision. Blue chip art refers to established names with deep buyer interest, institutional validation, and a track record of secondary market demand. Emerging artists are earlier in their careers, which creates more upside potential, but far less certainty. Prints and photography can offer more accessible prices and clearer editioning, though quality still varies widely. Digital art and non-fungible token art occupy a newer and more speculative space, where technical novelty can outrun durable demand. These categories are not moral judgments. They are risk buckets. Each one behaves differently in terms of price stability, resale depth, and the kind of evidence you should demand before committing capital. The market channel matters just as much as the category. Primary market buying means buying directly from the artist or through a gallery representing the artist. In that setting, price is often set by the gallery and the artist together, and the work may be sold before it ever appears in a public auction. Secondary market buying means acquiring a work after an initial sale, whether through auction, a dealer, a private transaction, or a resale platform. That distinction changes almost everything. Primary market purchases can give you early access to an artist's career, but they also depend heavily on the gallery relationship and the artist's future trajectory. Secondary market purchases are easier to compare against public records, but they are also more exposed to market sentiment, condition issues, and seller urgency. Price discovery in art is therefore less direct than in public securities, but it is not mysterious. An auction estimate gives a range, not a promise. An asking price from a dealer is a starting point, not an end point. A negotiated gallery price can reflect loyalty, scarcity, or long-term positioning rather than a clean market clearing price. At auction, buyer demand can push a lot beyond its estimate if the room wants it badly enough, or leave it unsold if interest is thin. The work itself may be the same, but the market around it is not. That is why headlines should be treated as signals rather than forecasts. A splashy result can tell you that demand exists in a segment. It cannot prove that every work in that segment will perform equally well. The better guide is the cycle. After the 2008 contraction, the art market weakened as broader financial stress cut into discretionary spending and confidence. During the pandemic years, digital buying surged as more of the market moved online and as some collectors chased established names with renewed urgency. By early 2024, caution had returned in many corners, especially where prices had outrun underlying depth. That sequence matters because art does not sit outside the economy. Wealth creation, liquidity, and sentiment all shape who buys and at what price. A single auction result can be dramatic, but a cycle tells you whether the drama is part of a broader pattern or just a temporary spike. The public sales that usually enter the conversation are useful here because they come from different parts of the market. A Warhol sale can signal blue-chip scarcity. A Basquiat result can speak to contemporary demand and enduring cultural status. Beeple became a reference point for digital speculation, especially after the March 11th, 2021 sale that brought the NFT conversation into mainstream finance. Banksy, meanwhile, often signals spectacle as much as scarcity because the artist's market has long mixed irony, brand recognition, and public fascination. Those names are not interchangeable. They are case studies in how different segments attract attention for different reasons. The mistake is to treat them as proof that art always rises. The more useful reading is narrower. Each headline shows that a distinct collector base is willing to pay for a distinct kind of story. Beginner mistakes tend to follow from ignoring that distinction. Hype is the obvious trap. A loud market can make a mediocre work look inevitable. The fee stack is the quieter trap. You may focus on hammer price or sticker price and forget premiums, commissions, shipping, insurance, storage, and possible tax frictions. Weak documentation is another. A bargain can become expensive if the provenance is thin, the condition is compromised, or authenticity is uncertain. And many first-time buyers make the most dangerous error of all. They treat art like a fast trade. Art is usually not built for speed. It rewards patience, comparison, and a willingness to wait for a genuinely suitable exit. That exit question should be asked before the first bid, not after it. Who might buy this later? Through which channel? At what cost? After what holding period? Those are not abstract questions. They are the heart of the investment thesis. You should think through whether the likely exit is an auction room, a private sale, a dealer buyback, a gallery relationship, or a platform resale market. Each path has different fees, timing, and probability of success. If no plausible exit exists except luck, then the purchase is not an investment thesis. It is a personal indulgence with financial risk attached. That may still be acceptable, but it should be labelled honestly. This is where taste and thesis have to be separated. Liking a work is valuable. Taste helps you recognize quality, originality, and presence. It can also keep the process enjoyable, which matters when the holding period may be long. But liking a work does not replace evidence about the artist's trajectory, the scarcity of comparable works, the strength of recent demand, or the depth of the resale market. Taste tells you what feels compelling. Thesis tells you what might hold value under market scrutiny. The best purchases often contain both, but they are not the same thing, and confusing them in is one of the fastest ways to overpay. Before the first bid, liquidity and condition deserve special attention because both affect whether a future buyer will show up and what that buyer will accept. A work in poor condition can lose value even if the image remains powerful. A work that is hard to move because it sits in a narrow niche with little demand can also discount sharply when it comes time to sell. Documentation matters because it helps establish title, authenticity, exhibition history, and prior ownership. Condition matters because art is physical and physical objects age. You do not need to become a conservator, but you do need to ask for the records, inspect the surface, and understand what the work has survived. The decision filter is simple, even if the market itself is not. Start with budget, then test horizon, then test liquidity need, then test tolerance for uncertainty, then test willingness to do documentation-heavy due diligence. If any one of those answers is weak, the allocation should shrink or disappear. fine art can be rewarding, intellectually and financially, but only when you respect its structure. It is a market of uneven prices, patient money, and real-world objects. The next step is to compare the main buying channels and the evidence that can help you separate price from value. Blue-chip art is the most institutionally validated corner of the market. It means work by artists whose reputations have been reinforced over time by museums, major galleries, repeated auction demand, and, often, estates that manage supply with unusual discipline. That validation matters because it gives you more than a famous name. It gives you a longer record of how the market has treated the artist across different cycles, different buyers, and different sales channels. A blue chip name does not remove risk, but it does reduce some of the biggest unknowns. The public auction record makes that clear. On May the 17th, 2022, Christie's sold Andy Warhol's Shot Sage Blue Marilyn for $195 million. That result reflected the artist's global recognition, the work's scarcity, and the power of a single image to stand in for an entire career. On May 18th, 2017, Sotheby's sold Jean-Michel Basquiat's Untitled for $110.5 million. That sale showed how cultural stature and historical significance can keep demand intense decades after an artist's death. On March 11th, 2021, Christie's sold Beeple's Everydays, the first 5,000 days, for $69.3 million. That result became a reference point for digital speculation because it linked a new ownership format to an old appetite for novelty. On October 14th, 2021, Sotheby's sold Banksy's Love is in the Bin for £18.6 million. That sale blurred the line between artwork and performance, because the destruction itself became part of the object's market story. Those four results do not point in one direction. They show scarcity, cultural status, digital hype, and market theatre operating at once. That is why blue chip art can still be dangerous. The market often charges a premium not only for quality, but for reputation, convenience, and the comfort of buying a familiar name. Fees can quietly erode the return. Auction premiums, seller commissions, shipping, insurance, storage and tax friction all sit between the headline price and the real economics. Market cycles matter too. A work that looks expensive in a hot year can look merely ordinary in a cooler one. Collector taste shifts as well, and even within a famous artist's output, the market may reward one period, one subject, or one scale while ignoring another. A lesser work by a famous name can underperform a stronger work by a less celebrated artist, which is why the artist's brand is never enough on its own. Estate-controlled supply adds another layer. When an estate manages an artist's market carefully, it can preserve scarcity and support prices, but it can also limit what reaches buyers. You are then paying not only for the object, but for a whole infrastructure of validation around it. A museum presence, a major gallery relationship, and repeated auction support all help, yet none of them guarantee that a particular piece is the right purchase. The safest blue chip buy is usually the best work you can afford from the artist, not the cheapest way to get the name. At the other end of the spectrum, emerging artists offer the highest variance. Entry prices are lower, which makes them tempting, but the resale market is thinner, and the path from early attention to durable recognition is long. Many emerging artists get a burst of interest and then stall. The validation path is demanding. It usually begins with gallery representation, then fair visibility, then critical attention, then collector support, and finally the harder test of repeat sales that hold up after the initial excitement fades. If those second and third sales collapse, the early buzz was not market proof. It was only attention. The reason emerging work can still be worth considering is that the upside, if it arrives, can be significant. But that upside depends on a sequence of events you do not control. A museum acquisition can help. A strong review can help. Inclusion in a respected fair, biennial, or gallery program can help. What matters is not just the first sale, but the market's willingness to return. Without that return, an emerging purchase may remain a private pleasure rather than an asset with a real exit path. Mid-career artists sit in the middle zone between that uncertainty and blue-chip pricing. They often have enough exhibition history, enough gallery support, and enough auction activity to give you a track record, but not the full premium attached to the most famous names. For many first-time investors, that middle zone is useful because it reduces the binary feeling of the decision. The artist is no longer a pure gamble, yet the price has not climbed into the territory where every mistake becomes expensive. That does not make the work safe. It simply means the market has already produced more evidence than it has for a very young artist. Prints are often the first practical entry point for exactly that reason. A print can let you access a recognized body of work at a lower price, but only if the edition is clear, the signature is credible, the paper is sound, and the image belongs to a market-recognized series or body of work. A print by a famous artist is not automatically a good print. The edition size matters. The condition of the paper matters. The quality of the impression matters. And the market cares whether the work was issued under proper control or whether the edition history is vague. Photography works in a similar way, though the pricing logic is often more explicit. Editions are usually clearer, so the market can build price ladders around print type, size, age, and display history. A later print can price differently from an early one. A large print can price differently from a small one. A work that has been poorly stored or heavily exposed to light, it can lose value even when the image itself is iconic. Photography rewards precision because the object exists in multiple instances and you are paying for the combination of image, edition logic, and physical quality. Sculpture and three-dimensional work introduce a different kind of friction. Ownership is harder because the object may require special installation, careful shipping, secure storage, and ongoing conservation. Materials can age unevenly. Welding can weaken. Surface finishes can change. If a work has multiple components, every missing part matters. Edition integrity matters too, because many sculptures are produced in limited runs, and the market needs to know exactly where the object sits within that run. The challenge is not just buying the work, it is also supporting it physically for as long as you own it. Digital art and non-fungible token art are the most speculative categories of all. The attraction is obvious. They offer novelty, low marginal production cost, and a digitally native audience. The risks are also obvious once you name them. Wallet custody can fail. Platform permanence is not guaranteed. A file can become inaccessible or detached from its certificate. Intellectual property terms may not be what you assume. Resale depth can be thin. In this category, the object may exist as both image and code, and either layer can become a problem. The question is not only whether the art is interesting, but whether the ownership structure is durable enough to support a future sale. Once the category is clear, provenance becomes the next filter. In plain language, provenance is the ownership chain that helps support legal title, authenticity confidence, and future buyer trust. It is the story of where the work has been, who held it, and what documents connect one owner to the next. That chain does more than satisfy curiosity. It helps you judge whether the work is legally clean and whether future buyers are likely to trust it. A good provenance file can also support price because it reduces uncertainty. The red flags are usually easier to spot than the strengths. Unexplained gaps in ownership are one. Inconsistent documents are another. Unclear export history, doubtful invoices, and missing edition information all weaken confidence. So does wartime uncertainty for European works from 1939 to 1945, when looting, forced sales, and incomplete records still complicate title in some cases. Those cases deserve special care because the issue is not merely market value. It is legal and title risk. Title risk is part of provenance, and it matters even when the seller seems trustworthy. Restitution claims can arise. Import and export questions can surface. A seller's word may be sincere and still incomplete. That is why you should not rely on personal assurance alone. You need documents, chain of custody, and, when relevant, legal review. A clean story is helpful. A documented story is stronger. A documented story with no obvious gaps is stronger still. Reputation is another bundle of signals that deserves careful reading. For art, reputation is not a feeling. It is a record built from museums, critics, major galleries, catalogue entries, collector networks, estate management, and repeated auction support. Those elements matter because they show that the market has kept returning to the artist over time. A single famous collector or a single flashy sale can create noise. A long pattern of institutional and market support creates something more durable. You want the latter. Condition is the next major value driver, and it behaves differently across media. On paper, fading, tears, foxing, and poor handling can all reduce value. Foxing is the brown spotting that appears on older paper, often from age or moisture. On canvas, relining and overpainting can alter both appearance and collectability. On photographic prints, display history, and light exposure matter because the image surface can degrade. On sculpture, unstable materials and damaged components can be expensive to repair. On digital assets, the problem may be corrupted or inaccessible files. A work can remain visually impressive and still suffer a serious market discount if condition is compromised. That is why you need to know the difference between age and damage. Some signs of age are expected, some are not. A conservator can help sort that out, but even a non-specialist can ask the right questions. Has the work been restored? Has it been relined? Has the frame been replaced? Has it been stored in a stable environment? For a digital work, can the file still be accessed? Does the owner control the wallet? Is the associated file intact? Those are not fussy questions, they are basic risk questions. Authenticity sits beside condition, but it is not the same thing. A work can be in great condition and still be wrong. The main tools for authenticity are the catalogue raisonné, which is the scholarly record of accepted works by an artist, artist estates, foundation records, expert review, conservation examination, scientific testing when needed, and consistency between the object and its documented history. No single tool is perfect. The strongest cases usually combine several. An expert may recognize the hand. A conservation exam may confirm period materials. The archive may align with the object's ownership trail. The point is not certainty by slogan. It is convergence. Edition mechanics matter, especially in prints and photography. You need to know the edition size, whether artist proofs were issued, whether printer's proofs exist, whether the signature is hand-applied or printed, and whether the work is a posthumous issue. An artist proof is a small number of impressions kept aside for the artist. A printer's proof is reserved for the printer or publisher. Those details affect scarcity. They also affect price. A clearly bounded edition usually inspires more confidence than one that has been extended, reissued, or described loosely over time. Exhibition history adds another kind of evidence. If a work has appeared in a recognized museum, a biennial, a fair, or a documented gallery program, that history can signal curatorial or institutional validation. Publication history can do the same. A work that appears in a catalogue, a monograph, an exhibition record, or a recognised market database is easier to place in the artist's larger story. That does not guarantee appreciation, but it helps prove that the object is not an isolated event. It has already moved through a meaningful part of the market and the record. Auction vocabulary is worth learning because the terms shape both risk and price. The estimate is the range the auction house believes the work may bring. The reserve is the minimum price the seller accepts. The hammer price is the number struck by the auctioneer before fees are added. The buyer's premium is the extra amount you pay on top of the hammer price. The seller commission is what the auction house may charge the consignor. A guarantee is a minimum result promised to the seller, sometimes by the house and sometimes by a third party. A private sale is a transaction arranged outside the public sale room. A buy-in is an unsold lot that failed to meet reserve. A buy-in is not proof that the artist's entire market is weak. It may simply mean that the price was too aggressive for that day, that the reserve was too high, or that the right bidder was absent. That caution matters because one sale can be misleading. A result may reflect rarity, timing, a guarantee, marketing, or even two determined bidders who wanted the same object badly enough to push it well past expectations. The price can look like a trend when it is really a one-off event. To judge whether a number is reasonable, you should use comparable work analysis. The relevant comparables are medium, size, date, image quality, subject, condition, edition, provenance, and sale venue. A small print from a quiet sale is not the same thing as a major canvas from a global evening auction. Same artist does not mean same market. That is where Sotheby's and Christie's matter most. They are not only auction houses, they are also private sale channels with global reach, specialist departments, condition reports, buyer premiums, and selective access to major consignments. Their specialists can help place a work in context, but they also operate in a system where scarcity and presentation shape outcomes. You may see a public estimate, yet the actual economics can be influenced by reserve, guarantees, and private negotiations behind the scenes. The public result is useful. It is not the whole machine. Online discovery platforms and reputable galleries play a different role. Artsy and similar marketplaces help you discover inventory and learn the names of artists and dealers. Good galleries provide primary market access and often know the work far better than a generic listing can show. But visibility is not the same as credibility. A work being easy to find online does not mean it is well-priced, well-documented, or well-supported in resale. You still have to distinguish credible representation from simple exposure. Fractional ownership platforms, such as Masterworks, introduce yet another model. They lower the ticket size by turning direct ownership and control into smaller claims on a managed pool or vehicle. That can make the category feel more accessible, but it also shifts several variables away from you. Fees matter. Disclosures matter. The assumed holding period matters. Secondary sale mechanics matter. Custody matters. Valuation method matters. Investor control matters. In a fractional structure, the trade-off is simple. You pay for access but give up direct control over when and how the asset is sold. Because of that, the best way to reduce mistakes is still stubbornly old-fashioned. Read the condition report. Examine the preview if possible. Ask how the work has been stored. Ask for the documentation. Ask who held it before. Ask whether the addition is complete. Ask whether the work has been restored, relined, repaired, or digitally altered. Then compare the object to truly similar works, not just to the artist's name. A careful process does not eliminate risk, but it turns a blind purchase into a reasoned one. The practical test is not whether the market can be exciting. It can. The test is whether a work fits the budget, the tolerance for uncertainty, the ownership costs, and a believable exit path. Once those pieces line up, the next question is how much of a starter collection should stay in the safe middle and how much should I be allowed to reach for growth. The starter budget frame is easiest to use in four bands: $5,000, $10,000, $25,000, and $50,000. Those numbers do not promise success. They simply mark the point at which you can start making deliberate choices instead of accidental ones. The first capital rule matters most. Never size an art purchase so large that one mistake can damage the wider financial plan. Art belongs inside a life that can absorb uncertainty, not threaten it. Emergency cash and core investments stay outside the art allocation because a work may take months or longer to sell, and the right buyer may not appear when you need one. At $5,000, the starter path is usually one disciplined entry, not a scattered hunt for bargains. A strong additioned print can be a sensible beginning if the addition is clear and the artist is credible. A small documented work on paper can work as well. A carefully selected emerging artist piece can also fit, but the upside is uncertain and the resale market may be thin. At this level, the goal is not to build a trophy wall. The goal is to buy one piece well enough that you learn how the market actually behaves. The $10,000 to $25,000 range opens a different kind of possibility. Here, you can pair one accessible blue chip print or photograph with one carefully documented emerging or mid-career work. That pairing keeps one foot in a market with more evidence and one foot in a market with more upside potential. The blue chip side gives you a deeper record of demand. The emerging or mid-career side leaves room for growth if the artist continues to develop. Even then, variety should not be confused with safety. Two works are not automatically more diversified than one if they sit in the same narrow niche, through the same channel, with the same weak documentation. Once the budget reaches $25,000 to $50,000, the logic shifts toward a core satellite mix. The core is the steadier work, the one backed by stronger market evidence, more recognizable demand, and a clearer resale path. The satellites are the smaller positions where uncertainty is higher, but potential upside may also be greater. That structure helps you avoid the two most common errors at once. It keeps you from overcommitting to speculation, and it keeps you from putting all the capital into one fully mature name that leaves no room for future growth. It is not flashy. It is a way of admitting that art markets reward patience more reliably than bravado. Below $25,000, diversification is not about piling up many separate artists. It is more practical than that. Diversification can happen through medium, channel, documentation quality, and artist stage. Medium diversification means spreading exposure across painting, works on paper, photography, sculpture, and digital art only when you understand the ownership demands of each form. Artist stage diversification means mixing blue chip, mid-career, and emerging names, while remembering that risk rises as the market record becomes thinner. Channel diversification means not relying on one door into the market. Gallery, auction, marketplace, dealer, and fractional purchases. Each carry different fees, access rules, documentation habits, and resale options. A beginner with a modest budget usually learns more by diversifying across those dimensions than by buying several similar works by similar names. Fractional ownership deserves a careful place in that conversation. It can lower the entry point into a category that would otherwise be out of reach, and for some buyers, that makes it a useful diversification tool. But it does not remove market risk, platform risk, fee risk, or liquidity risk. It simply changes where those risks sit. You may own a smaller economic slice, but the structure still depends on the platform's governance, valuation method, exit mechanics, and costs. In other words, a fractional position is not a shortcut around due diligence. It is a different wrapper around the same basic problem. How to buy intelligently when the asset is hard to price and hard to sell. The first purchase should also leave room for the boring costs that quietly shape the real return. Insurance, framing, shipping, customs, storage, appraisal, and a future sale commission all belong in the initial calculation. A work that looks affordable at the sticker price can become expensive once the full ownership path is visible. That is why the quoted price is never the whole story. If you spend every available dollar on the object itself, you may discover that there is no margin left for the practical life of the work. The better habit is to think in terms of total ownership cost, not just acquisition cost. The buying process itself is straightforward once you lay it out in sequence. It begins with a shortlist, then moves to inquiry. After that comes document review, preview or inspection, condition review, price comparison, negotiation, payment, shipping, and cataloguing. Each step answers a different question. The shortlist asks whether the work belongs in the conversation at all. The inquiry asks whether it is actually available and on what terms. The document review asks whether the work has a supportable history. The preview or inspection asks whether the object in front of you matches the story around it. The condition review asks what age and wear have done to the work. The price comparison asks whether the asking price makes sense beside similar works. The negotiation asks whether the market leaves room to improve the number. Payment and shipping close the deal. Cataloguing makes the purchase legible for the future. Before any money changes hands, the pre-purchase document set should be complete enough to reduce surprises later. Provenance matters because it traces the ownership chain. Invoice history matters where available because it helps show what was paid and when. A condition report matters because physical state affects value. The authenticity basis matters because no buyer should rely on vague assurances where the market expects evidence. Edition details matter for prints and photographs because scarcity depends on how the edition was issued. Seller identity matters because you need to know who is actually transferring the work. And all buyer costs need to be written down because the sticker price alone can hide a very expensive reality. Good documents do not eliminate risk, but they make the risk visible. The fee stack is where many first-time buyers lose track of the economics. Buyer's premium, seller commission, platform fee, taxes, shipping, insurance, storage, currency, conversion, appraisal, and conservation where needed, can all sit between the headline price and the final cost. A number that looks tolerable at first can change once those layers are added. The remedy is not paranoia. It is arithmetic. If the final cost is still acceptable after the full stack is counted, the purchase may remain attractive. If not, you have learned something useful before a mistake becomes permanent. That matters because transaction friction is not a side issue. It is part of the market structure. Tax handling deserves a clear frame because it can alter the economics in both the United States and Canada. In the United States, collectibles treatment can expose gains to different tax handling than many ordinary long-term holdings. Sales tax, use tax, donation documentation, estate planning, and careful record keeping can all matter depending on how the work is acquired and later transferred. In Canada, capital gains treatment is central, but trading activity that begins to resemble a business can raise the possibility of business income treatment. Sales tax, import tax, and record keeping also matter there. The broad lesson is the same on both sides of the border. Tax consequences do not live after the purchase. They are part of the purchase decision itself, because they change what the work really costs and what a future sale may yield. Cross-border buying between the United States and Canada is therefore a cost issue before it is anything else. Shipping, customs, duties, currency movement, insurance in transit, and import paperwork can all affect the real purchase price. A buyer may see a desirable work in one market and assume the listed price is enough to compare it with a local alternative. That is rarely true. Exchange rates can move the economics. Shipping can be expensive. Customs and paperwork can slow the process. Insurance has to cover transit, not just the wall. The result is that a lower quoted price in one country may turn into a higher total cost once the practical path is complete. Storage is another ownership decision with real financial consequences. Some works are fine at home if the environment is stable and the display is careful. Others belong in secure off-site storage. Higher value or delicate works may require professional fine art storage, where temperature, humidity, handling, and security are managed more rigorously. The medium matters here. Paintings, works on paper, photographs, sculpture, and digital objects do not all age in the same way, and they do not all require the same physical support. A buyer who ignores storage can lose value through preventable damage. A buyer who plans storage from the start protects both the object and the exit price. Insurance follows the same logic. Scheduled coverage, declared value, updated appraisals, transit coverage, and proof of ownership all matter when a claim arises. The policy should match the object's current value and location, not an outdated estimate from the year of purchase. A work that has appreciated may need updated coverage. A work that is frequently moved may need transit protection. A work with a complicated ownership trail may need especially clean records to support a claim. Insurance is often treated as an afterthought, but it is really part of the preservation system. The ongoing ownership routine is not glamorous, but it is how the investment stays legible. Catalogue the work, keep invoices and photographs, record dimensions and condition, store documents securely, update insurance values when needed. If the work changes location, note that too. If it is conserved or reframed, keep the record. If the market changes materially, save the relevant comparables. These habits matter because art ownership is not only about acquisition. It is about maintaining the evidence that supports future sale, future insurance, and future valuation. Liquidity in practice means having more than one plausible exit. Resale may happen through auction, private sale, gallery resale, dealer purchase, marketplace listing, or platform exit. Each path has a different speed and a different cost structure. Auction can bring exposure to a wide buyer base, but it also comes with public timing, commissions, reserve negotiation, and the risk of an unsold lot. Private sale may protect privacy and allow flexibility, but it depends on relationships and may take time to arrange. Gallery resale or dealer purchase can be efficient if the right contact exists, though the offered price may reflect the dealer's need for margin. Marketplace listing widens visibility, but the buyer still needs confidence in the object and the paperwork. A platform exit can work for fractional structures, yet it may be constrained by the platform's own rules and market depth. Resale friction is the quiet reason patience matters. Buyer premiums, seller commissions, catalogue timing, reserve negotiation, shipping, taxes, failed sale risk, and the possibility of accepting a discount for speed all reduce the recovery number. A rushed sale can force the work into a weak venue or a weak moment. A patient hold gives market evidence and artist validation time to develop. That does not guarantee a better price, but it improves the odds that the sale happens in a venue that can recognize the work properly. Patience and delay are not the same thing. Patience means waiting because the market and the object justify it. Delay means waiting while uncertainty accumulates. That is why you should think about the exticket before the entry. If the likely resale path is unclear, the purchase is not yet ready. If the likely sale requires a deep discount for speed, you should know that in advance. If the work only makes sense under a long hold, that should be written into the thesis. Art rewards the buyer who can tolerate time, but it punishes the buyer who must solve cash needs with a slow asset. Liquidity is not a side note. It is the structural constraint that separates a thoughtful purchase from an expensive surprise. Scam signals tend to show up early if you know what to look for. Guaranteed returns are a warning. So is fake provenance, vague seller identity, pressure sales, off-platform wire requests, manipulated appraisals, unrealistic discounts, and refusal to document fees. These are not small etiquette lapses. They are signs that the seller does not want you to inspect the structure of the deal. A legitimate transaction can still be complex, but it should not be secretive about the basics. If the person on the other side of the deal will not explain the paperwork, the costs, or the chain of title, the safest response is to step away. The walkaway conditions should be just as clear. Missing title support is enough. No condition information is enough. Unclear addition details are enough. Unverifiable authenticity claims are enough. Unexplained price urgency is enough. And a seller who will not put costs in writing is enough. You do not need to prove fraud to leave the deal. The absence of a clean case is itself a reason to stop. In art, restraint is often a better skill than enthusiasm. A one-page purchase thesis can keep that restraint organized. It should cover the artist, the work, the price, the reason for buying, the holding period, and the likely exit route. That is enough to force clarity without turning the process into a legal brief. You should be able to explain why this work, why this price, why this channel, why this holding period, and why now. If those answers are weak, the purchase is weak. If they are strong, you have a coherent basis for action rather than a vague attraction to a famous name. A due diligence checklist makes the process repeatable. It should include provenance, title, condition, authenticity, edition integrity, fee stack, storage, insurance, taxes, and exit path. A checklist does not replace judgment. It protects judgment from being overwhelmed by excitement. It also helps you compare one opportunity with another without relying on memory alone. That matters because art deals can move through different channels with different documents and different timelines. A checklist keeps the standards constant even when the market presentation changes. You should also compare at least three buying routes for the same type of work before committing. A gallery, an auction, a marketplace, a dealer, or a fractional platform can all lead to the same broad category, but not to the same economics. The route changes the fees, the documentation, the bargaining power, and the resale options. If one channel looks better than the others after comparison, you have earned that conclusion. If not, the comparison itself may reveal that the work is not priced attractively enough to justify the chosen route. Either way, the process improves the decision. An annual review cadence keeps the ownership plan alive. Conditions should be checked. Documentation should be updated. Insurance value should be reassessed. Market comparables should be reviewed. Possible resale routes should be reconsidered. That yearly rhythm matters because art is not a static object in a static market. The work ages. The artist's market changes. The insurance market changes. Your own finances may change. A good annual review turns ownership from passive possession into active stewardship. The personal allocation rule should stay simple enough to remember. Art remains a small, optional slice of a wider financial life. When art is oversized, every market wobble feels like a threat. When art is modestly sized, you can think clearly, hold patiently, and choose well. The decision rule that follows from that is equally direct. You should be able to explain why this work, why this price, why this channel, why this holding period, and why now. If that explanation exists in plain language, the purchase has a structure. If it does not, you still have time to wait. By the end of this guide, the logic is meant to feel practical rather than mystical. Fine art can sit inside a North American portfolio as an alternative asset, but only when it is small enough to remain optional, documented well enough to remain saleable, and patient enough to survive the market's delays. It works best when the purchase is deliberate, the records are clean, and the holding period gives the market time to find the right next buyer. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.